Studio 360.
There must be some kind of way out of here. Say the Joker to the thief.
That's Jimi Hendrix, of course. He is a late 60s rock and roll pioneer and African-American. But what people tend to overlook about Jimi Hendrix is that he also strongly identified as Cherokee.
Being part Native was very meaningful to my grandmother.
That's Janie Hendrix, Jimmy's sister.
She talked about that a lot and really instilled that in all of us, but especially Jimmy.
It's really no wonder that the contributions of Native Americans to rock have gone unrecognized. After all, it isn't always obvious from some guitarist or drummer's appearance that he's Chippewa. And some musicians back in the day, worried about discrimination, did not exactly advertise their ancestry. But it turns out that, yes, Native American rock musicians have been influential, musically and otherwise. That influence was the subject of an exhibit at the Smithsonian a few years ago, and is now the subject of a really illuminating documentary called Rumble, The Indians Who Rocked the World. The film was produced by Stevie Salas, a guitarist who's performed with Rod Stewart and Mick Jagger and George Clinton and lots more, and who is Apache. Stevie and I talked about his film and the music that inspired it.
Well, really, it's been in the works for most of my life. But what happened was, first, it was just curiosity. I grew up on the beach in San Diego. My father left Wyoming, and my mother's family had left New Mexico, and I never really saw myself as different. And I moved to L.A. in 1985 after high school, and I got this huge gig playing with Rod Stewart. But I would notice that there's just not too many people that look like me. I'd be on tour, and I was in this massive band, playing, five nights at Madison Square Gardens or whatever. But I just didn't see anybody look like me. I just started getting curious. That's also, I started to do a little digging on the subject back then and where people were from.
I want to ask you about this film's director, who is an Anglo woman from Canada named Catherine Bainbridge, all of whose work seems to be movies and TV shows about Native people. So tell me about her. Why is that her professional mission?
Well, it's because she's married to a Cree man from way up in Chisasibi near the Hudson Bay, and her children are Native children. And she's really passionate about the history, and she's really, really good with that stuff.
Well, one great thing about this film is that there are obviously gigantic musicians like Jimi Hendrix that one has knew and has heard of. But some people, a lot of people, a shockingly lot of people who were big deals whom I'd never heard of and were influential. Like, let's start, for instance, with one of your favorites, a guy you mentioned, Link Wray. Here's maybe his most famous track. That was Rumble by Link Wray and his Rayman in 1957. So what do you love about that?
Well, you know what's really a trip about that is it's the song that first invented really the distorted power chord. In 1957, you got this distorted thing coming out of the guitar that Pete Townsend is freaking out. That Jeff Beck told me him and Jimmy Page would play air guitar to that song. And so it influenced everybody that influenced me. And Slash talked a lot about that with me because Slash and I kind of came up together. And, all of us guys, we listen to Townsend, Dave Davies. We all listen to Jimmy Page. We all listen to Jeff Beck and Clapton. I mean, those are the guys. And then he says, I was wondering one day, who did they listen to? And he said, the more he dug, the name that always came up was Link Wray. And you realize that this is a massively unsung person.
Yeah, okay, we know Chuck Berry. We know some of the farthest, deepest godfathers of rock and roll. But this, to me, it's like, whoa, this is the moment rock is being invented, and this just sounds so hard and unwatered down and cool. And it was amazing to discover who did this.
And that song with no lyrics was banned from radio because it was inciting teen violence. And it's not even any lyrics, right?
Right.
So he's touching a nerve big time, right? So he influences, you know, the people that are the Mount Rushmore of rock, the Townsend, Page, Beck. You know, he gets the big guys. Now they go on, and Link Wray sort of goes off into obscurity to the public.
So did he kind of he influence you kind of second and third hand through the Jeff Becks and
yes.
so forth? Yeah.
Like most people my age, we didn't even realize. You know, same with Jesse Ed Davis. We didn't realize we were getting influenced by these guys because we had to go back and search who they influenced, and that's when we realized how important they were.
Jesse Ed Davis is a guitarist I'd heard of from liner notes growing up. I had no idea who he was, but I the name is familiar because he was on Beatles albums and Eric Clapton albums and Jackson Brown albums and so many others. Here is one of the extremely well-known tracks he played on. Whatever gets you through the night. That is, of course, Whatever Gets You Through the Night by John Lennon with Elton John and Jesse Ed Davis on guitar. Tell the listeners a little something about Jesse Ed.
Well, I was exactly like you, okay? So I used to, you know, I remember the Atlantic Crossing album by Rod Stewart came out, I think, when I was in fifth grade or sixth grade or something like that. And I remember reading the liner notes, and I'd see the song written by Jesse Ed Davis, Jesse Ed Davis on guitar. I'd see that name everywhere, having no idea he was a Native American man. I then later on would join Rod Stewart's band as my first big band. My first band really joined since high school. And I would learn Jesse Ed Davis guitar parts, not realizing I was learning guitar parts by a Native American man. Huh. Here, while I'm on tour with Rod Stewart searching for Native American musicians, I'm playing some of his guitar parts, not knowing he's a Native American musician. And then later on, you know, we started getting into it. We started to find out, you know, Brad Whitford from Aerosmith goes, you know, I love Jesse Ed Davis. And he's, you know, and I see it, he would dress like an Indian, but I thought he just dressed like that because he looked cool. I didn't realize he was an actual Native American, you know, which was great. And then Jackson Brown said, yeah, it was, you know, everybody dressed like an Indian then. It was the cool thing to do. Yeah. So you didn't know if he was actually really one, right? And now when I watch the Bangladesh footage with Clapton and George Harrison.
The 1971 concert for Bangladesh, yeah. The big benefit.
And there he is right there. It's got Clapton on one side, and it's got Jesse on his left. And you know, Jesse was a big, big man. So you got this big, gigantic Native American man standing right next to Clapton and right next to George Harrison. And I'm thinking, how did I not look at that footage my whole life? I go, who's that Indian on the stage there?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's like so obvious now that you know.
Yes. Well, which is my experience of watching this film in general. It's like, wait, this stuff I've been looking at my entire life, suddenly now, wait, all of these Native Americans stepped out of the shadows that were, and they were just, we were looking at them all the time.
They were right there in plain sight. You know, it's funny, because David Frick is our musicologist, right, for the movie.
He was a Rolling Stone writer, right?
He's the senior editor at Rolling Stone or something like that. He knew everything about this. It was like, oh, yeah. It's like, why didn't anybody tell anybody?
Yeah. Our next track is a guy who might vaguely heard of because I know what I know about the blues. This is Charlie Patton. It is in my pony. I love my black That's Charlie Patton playing Pony Blues in 1929, which sounds pretty classic African-American blues to me, but tell me about Charlie Patton and what you hear there, you know?
Well, what you just said is funny, right? Because it's true. We are all brought up to believe that was the blues was a black art form. And it wasn't until we started to dig in there, you know, Billy Gibbons said to me one day, you know, Charlie Patton, if you look at him closely, he had some curly, wavy blonde hair. And I'm like, what? And then we started to find those quotes like from Howlin' Wolf. And those people say, man, this Native American guy taught me how to play guitar. And you started to realize that what was really going on was the birth of our nation, a music being a byproduct of it, was all these cultures being mixed up. And that's what created the sound and the feeling and the sort of what our country turned into, North America, Canada included.
Well, and there's a great scene in the film that was to me musically revelatory, where you have these native women in the South singing their native songs, which sound And you suddenly, watching that, you suddenly get, oh, I get this connection to the blues.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? I mean, if I didn't know what the story was, I would just assume they were singing the blues.
Yeah.
It was a black, that black art form. But what we're, really trying to say is that it isn't really just a black art form. It is a black art form, a native art form, and many other cultures that created that. So we're not saying the Indians did it and the black people didn't or whatever. It's all of it together, like a gumbo, like Ivan Neville says in the film.
To me, I think of gumbo, which is the quintessential New Orleans food. When I was growing up, gumbo was you put everything you had in a pot. All that stuff together makes this great meal. I'm part Native American, part African by way of Haiti, part French, part Italian. And that's kind of what New Orleans is. And it comes out so flavorful.
Another thing, when you're talking about the connections between Native music and the blues, is how the playing the guitar like a drum, which again, I never thought of. That's an interesting connection as well.
I never thought of that either, man. Catherine really, really found that stuff and pulled it out, and it enlightened me as well, because I never really realized that, you know, because when they played, they didn't have the band, right? So the beat on the guitar would be your drum beat, and you'd have your four on the floor is like your powwow. Your powwow beat, then you'd have your polyrhythms, your African polyrhythms mixed in there, chicka-chinka-chinka-chinka-chinka, you know what I mean? All of a sudden, now it's the sound of the blues, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So Robbie Robertson, who has been one of my favorite musicians since I was a teenager and first heard the band and bought every record they ever made, talk about him. He's a big figure in this film.
He's really the Holy Grail, isn't he? I mean, if you think about Robbie Robertson has the muscle as a Native American man to do pretty much what he wants, and he has the cachet. And he was super important, because if he wouldn't have been in the Smithsonian exhibit, it just wouldn't have worked, because... You know, there's always these people that are going to say, like, well, I never heard of Jesse Ed Davis or Link Wray. Come on, you guys are just fishing. But when there's nobody's questioning Robbie Robertson.
Right.
He is beyond a legend. You know, Taylor Hawkins from the Foo Fighters said, you know, Robbie Robertson, everybody wants to be, I want to play in the band, you know.
Yeah. So
he is super important for this film, because he really brought the anchor of credibility.
As you were making this documentary, did you think, okay, this is how I want... non-native audiences, which will obviously be most of your audience, to see this and come away thinking about it this way, and this is what I want, what I want native people to see in this film and feel about this film?
Once I turned 40, I said, okay, I've spent the first half of my life really being selfish and, you know, trying to be rich and trying to be famous and all this stuff, which was really fun. I loved it. I've had some great times. But I wanted to go back to Indian country, and I wanted to try to help, because I'd see people beating their heads against the wall. And one of the things I realized was they didn't have a lot of role models. You know, there's not a lot of role models in Indian country other than, you know, history. You know, Geronimo and...
Yeah, Sitting Bull.
Thing. Yeah, yeah. And so I knew that these musicians would prove that, look, anything is possible. These guys did it, and especially in times where you could get killed for it, right? And... I wanted them to have some role models. I wanted us to have role models that were, you know, represented, that were somebody you could be proud of. But then what happened was, once Catherine started digging deeper into the history and even the Smithsonian, big time in the Smithsonian, actually, I should say, we started to realize that we were unearthing some history, American history, that had never been told, that never was known. We knew the black story with rock and Robert Johnson and Little Richard. We knew the white story with rock and roll when Elvis popped and in the Beatles. But there was a red story we never knew about. And now it's out, and that's something I'm the most proud of, that the film has really rewritten some wrongs. And we're not saying we did this, you didn't do this. We're just saying these guys did this, and it's important.
Right.
And it should be recognized, and it will be recognized from now on. And if I die and that's what the film did, then I'm good with that.
Well, Stevie Salas, you really have. And congratulations for educating me and entertaining me. And I think a lot of all the people who see this film as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
Rumble, The Indians Who Rock the World, came out over the summer and is now available on iTunes and Amazon. You can find a Spotify playlist of the music you heard in this piece at our website, pri.org/studio360.